This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Most American history textbooks describe the Underground Railroad as a shadowy network of abolitionists and fugitive slaves, fearless soldiers of freedom who risked their lives in the years before and during the Civil War to help blacks escape the horrors of slavery. All of us learn one name, that of the almost mythical Harriet Tubman. This romantic story has evolved into what writer Fergus Bordewick calls a kind of national fairy tale that overlooks almost everyone else who took part, why they did it, and what it all meant. Later in the program, a story of infidelity, violence, a resourceful widow, and the seduction of an innocent. Relax, we're talking about Humboldt penguins here. But first, the passengers, conductors, station managers, and the legacy of the Underground Railroad. If you have questions about how this clandestine network worked and or about the Americans who created and operated it, give us a phone call. Was your town a stop on the Underground Railroad? Our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And the email address is totn@npr.org. Joining us now from the studios of Mississippi Public Broadcasting in Jackson, Mississippi, is Fergus Bordewick. His new book is Bound for Canaan, The Underground Railroad and the War for the Soul of America. Very nice of you to be with us today on Talk of the Nation.
Hello, Neil. Thanks so much for having me.
So why has history forgotten the names of people like Levi Coffin, Josiah Henson?
Well, first let me say the names that we do know, Harriet Tubman, Frederick Douglass, really were also heroic people and definitely deserve the kind of honor that we've given them. But yes, why have we forgotten almost everyone else, and why is it that we've forgotten that the Underground Railroad was much more than a picturesque legend? Frankly, I think because after the Civil War, this country first abandoned African Americans who were freed as a result of emancipation, and beyond that, as the country adopted a culture of segregation and institutionalized racism, during the long, dark night of the Jim Crow era, we suppressed, or at least aggressively forgot, the racial radicalism and the fact of the Underground Railroad and the fact that the Underground was the country's first integrated political movement in which African Americans were not only participants, but often leaders.
And that's an important point. You say in the book that, you know, again, our image of the Underground Railroad is, you know, those brave white abolitionists and the terrified slaves.
Yes, indeed. I think that's the comfortable story that we told ourselves in the intervening several generations when African Americans were pushed to the margins of society and racism was institutionalized. But it's quite clear that black Americans led many of the cells of the Underground Railroad, organized many of them, including in New York City, Detroit, Michigan, many, many other places. And white Americans who participated equally courageously generally received no special privilege owing to their color.
And you find this biracial aspect of this story, let's call it an American aspect to this story, really, going back to the very early days of this movement, before there was such a thing as an underground railroad, before there were railroads, for that matter, back in Philadelphia's Quaker community, just not long after the Revolutionary War.
Absolutely. The Underground Railroad's roots are traceable to Philadelphia in the 1790s. And you might ask, well, why did it begin then and why there? Because until there were truly free states, there was really no place to run to. And we need to remember that all our states, with the exception of Vermont, as it happens, were slave states. As late as 1776, New York had as many slaves as Georgia. And the first place in the country where large numbers of people became emancipated was in Quaker Philadelphia, and it was at the end of the 1700s. And there, Quakers and free blacks, and indeed enslaved people as well, created a kind of synergy and began facilitating the flight of people, then, though, often from Pennsylvania, say, to New Jersey, or from New Jersey into Pennsylvania, as well as from the more familiar southern slave states further northward.
And why, in the Quaker community, why was that so important in terms of the white aspect of this story?
Yes, well, Quakers were the first white Americans to come to the conclusion that slavery was so fundamentally evil, so sinful, that individuals had to take personal responsibility for ending it. Quakers, to simplify a kind of complex theology, came to believe fairly early in the 1700s that every individual, including African Americans, possessed a sort of fragment of God, and that it was unspeakably sinful to presume to enslave God himself. And Quakers, as I say, were the first out of the gate as active, ardent abolitionists, but not all Quakers were active, and the Quakers finally split over this issue. And as time went on, Presbyterians, Methodists, Congregationalists, and other people did join in.
But interesting that you're talking about Protestant religious groups as opposed to the more secular traditions of the Enlightenment, sort of embodied by Thomas Jefferson, who thought about this in the abstract but never put it into practical effect.
Yes, indeed. There's a chapter in my book about Jefferson's mind, actually. Thomas Jefferson's head embodied all the contradictions that Americans of his era had, certainly with respect to slavery. And on one hand, as we all know, he penned the soaring words of the Declaration of Independence, all men are created equal. And that phrase, of course, was very much a battle cry of the Underground Railroad and the abolitionist movement. But on the other hand, Jefferson, if you read his notes on the state of Virginia, was deeply and ineradicably racist. His descriptions of what he really thought about black Americans is very hard to read today, frankly. But to come back to the Underground Railroad, certainly the values embodied in the American Revolution also were one of the streams that flowed into the spirit of the people of the Underground.
Let's get some listeners involved in this conversation. We're talking with Furtis Bordewick about his new book, Bound for Canaan, The Underground Railroad and the War for the Soul of America. 800-989-8255 if you'd like to join us, or email us, TOTN@NPR.org. And let's talk with Chris. Chris is calling from Carmichael, California.
Hi. I just wanted to mention that we have an old book at home that I go through from time to time, and it's Levi Coffin's memoirs that he wrote in the late 1800s, and he mentioned members of my family who helped in that effort. One was a doctor, Dr. Way, that's W-A-Y, and then stories about how it was and how people came to their home at night, and if they were ill, they were treated by Dr. Way, and my people were Quakers, and they had ways of gathering clothing, because quite often they would show up barefoot and cold and starving, etc. And on one occasion, at least, they were called into court. One of them was called into court, Dr. Way was, and said that he was harboring runaway slaves. And as you know, Quakers didn't take off their hats in court, and so one of the clerks took his hat off and asked him about this, whether he was harboring runaway slaves. And he said, well, I am giving people rest and I'm giving them food, but since they are not allowed to speak in this courtroom, I cannot say what their situation is. And they let him go, and as he left, they said, oh, Dr. Way, you've forgotten your hat. And he said, no, sir, I have not forgotten my hat. You took it off, and you may now keep it. But it was quite interesting for me as a youngster to know that they were involved in that, as was an editor in North Carolina back in 1730s. who is writing against slavery.
Yeah, Furtis Borderwick, that book about Levi Coffin, he's one of the key figures, a part of a Quaker community in North Carolina.
Yes, indeed. And in fact, that was a very interesting call. I've mentioned Dr. Way at least once and probably a few times in my book, Bound for Canaan, and he was indeed one of the true heroes of the underground working in eastern Indiana. Levi Coffin, whom Chris mentioned, was with one of his close relatives, Vestal Coffin, the creator of the first long-distance underground line from their home in Guilford County, a heavily Quaker region in North Carolina near Greensboro, to Indiana. And indeed, one of their collaborators in North Carolina was a man who's known only to us as Saul, or Hamilton's Saul, who was an enslaved man. And I've written about him as well in Bound for Canaan. Mm-hmm. And the slaves who worked with the underground are, in many ways, it's true, unsung heroes. There were many people who chose to remain in slavery, even though they themselves could have left because they were in contact with the underground, but rather remained enslaved so that they could help others escape. Levi Coffin eventually himself moved to Indiana, then finally to Cincinnati, one of the towering figures of the underground over 40 years. And his Reminiscences, which Chris mentioned, is a volume that's one of the great Underground Railroad works.
And eventually, Hamilton Saul himself, though he stayed behind for a long time, was a passenger on the railroad he helped create.
Finally, yes, after spending approximately 20 years in North Carolina doing underground work, that's right.
Chris, thank you very much for the phone call. Very interesting.
Thank you for taking it.
We're talking with author Furtis Borderwick about how the Underground Railroad helped change American history. He's the author of Bound for Canaan, The Underground Railroad and the War for the Soul of America. You can read chapter one of his book and hear an audio excerpt of Bound for Canaan at our website. That's www.npr.org. Let's get another listener involved in the conversation. And Sarah joins us from Grosse Isle in Michigan.
Hello. I was raised on an island that is in the Detroit River, and one side of the island faces Canada. And I always wondered as a child why it was that so many slaves came all the way to Grosse Isle as their last stop to get all the way to Canada when Michigan was already a free state. And it's just interesting to me that there were people on this all-white island, and believe me, it still is almost all-white, who were so determined to help.
Furtis Borderwick?
Sure. It's an interesting place you mentioned. Well, you've brought up two different things there. First, the people who resided there, the white people whom you're referring to, and their willingness to help, certainly embodied a growing spirit in the northern states, although it took many decades to grow, frankly, because we have to remember that even in the free states, most white people were hostile to abolitionism, and fugitives were never totally free until they reached Canada, though in fact most, maybe contrary to what we assume, did stay and settle elsewhere in the United States rather than continue all the way to Canada. But there were people amongst our ancestors, our great-great-great-grandparents, who were willing to make extraordinary sacrifices to help fugitives. Why were people going on to Canada? Because only in Canada could they feel that they were completely protected by the law. Even though the northern states were nominally free, African Americans, frankly, free as well as enslaved in the South, could never really count on the law to stand up for them. And right up through the 1850s, slave hunters and masters from the South prowling for their lost property had the law on their side generally when they came hunting for fugitives. And even, let's take New York City for an example, was a slave hunter's paradise. And there was a collaboration there between magistrates, constables, police, lawyers, and slave hunters, known locally in the antebellum period as the New York Slave Catchers Club. And fugitives were snatched off the streets of New York City, and the authorities sped them out as fast as they could. And that's not so atypical of many places in the North.
Sarah, thank
I thank you very much for your answer. I know that I'm asking kind of as a child. Now as an adult, I'm much more realistic and understanding, but thank you very, very much.
thank you very much for the call, Sarah. There was also, as part of this, there was a, well, I guess it's called was called at the time the colonization movement. This was an idea which you describe as naive at the time, but the idea that the solution to the crisis of slavery was to send people back to Africa.
Yeah, ironically, colonization was the liberalism of its day, at least at the beginning. It was a movement introduced into the United States from England in the late 1700s. The idea behind it was that slaves would be emancipated peacefully, gradually, and then because white people would never be able to live comfortably with them, they should be repatriated back to Africa, as if all slaves, all Africans sort of came from the equivalent of one New England community or something, rather than from a multitude of different regions speaking different languages scattered all over West Africa. And many of the most prominent politicians in the United States who publicly criticized slavery, although they refused to support immediate emancipation, professed support for colonization. And Liberia, the state of Liberia, like Sierra Leone, both are products of the colonization movement. But very few people, very few thousands of people ever were repatriated to Africa that way.
Let's get another caller on the line. Now, this is Scott, and Scott's with us from LaGrange, Indiana.
Hello.
Hi.
I've been researching for about the past year and a half our local Underground Railroad heroes, and I found out that Benjamin Waterhouse, who just down the road from my office, was the first in Indiana arrested and convicted under the Fugitive Slave Act. I found a lot of drama in his story.
Like what?
The president, of course, that signed that law was Millard Fillmore. One of the prosecuting witnesses in that case was Cyrus Fillmore, the president's brother.
Hmm.
And I have also been able to find through circumstantial evidence some of the neighbors involved, Irish immigrants, converted Methodists, and through this I've been able to develop a play that I'm it's a puppet play that I'm telling the story throughout our county.
Go ahead, Fergus.
Well, that's a wonderful story, the Waterhouse story, and I think telling us that story makes a point that I wanted to make myself, which is that the Underground Railroad, though it was a national movement and in its mature years in the 1840s and 50s, was a network that extended pretty much all across the northern states. Nonetheless, sort of like the modern internet, though it was very efficient and interlocking, had no central direction at all. It was a grassroots movement. In fact, it was really the first grassroots political movement in our history, and therefore highly localized. And the best material on the Underground Railroad today is to be found in local archives, local libraries, and indeed local tradition, insofar as it can be documented. And this is the this case that you're talking about is the kind of one that really reveals the workings of the Underground. Thank you very much for sharing it.
And good luck with the play, Scott.
It's a lot of fun.
Bye-bye.
Good day.
I want to ask you a little bit more about that analogy we're talking about. We think of a railroad, and of course there is always a president of a railroad, and there was a man who was nicknamed the president of the Underground Railroad, but you really describe this much more as a leaderless revolution.
Yeah, very much so. As I said, it was a grassroots movement right from the beginning. Why do we call it the Underground Railroad? Well, because it, The Underground's period of greatest expansion was from the 1830s through the 40s and the 50s, and it was exactly simultaneous with the spread of iron railroads around the United States, and the lingo of iron railroads lent itself perfectly to what the Underground had already been doing for about 30 years. That's to say, speaking of safe houses as stations and the people who lived there as station masters and guides on the Underground as conductors and farm wagons in which fugitives were carried as trains and the teams that pulled them as engines and so on and so on. But the Underground Railroad evolved, and it evolved rapidly, really out of the evangelical revival of the early 19th century. And most whites, by far, the great majority, were driven by what it seems to me should be called a spiritual imperative, a deep, profoundly religious, evangelical need to erase the sin of slavery from the country, because they felt and were taught that they personally were tainted by it. Now, I say whites because African Americans who participated in the Underground, well, of course, they regarded slavery as a sin, really didn't require a lot of theological architecture to explain why slavery was wrong. African Americans knew why slavery was wrong because so many had themselves been enslaved or had families still in slavery. And underground nodes of cells, if you like, developed from church congregations, families, and then began interlinking themselves as time went on.
Do we know how many people worked on the Underground Railroad and how many passengers rode on it to freedom?
Well, numbers are sort of the holy grail of Underground Railroad research. That's to say, of course, nobody was standing on the shore in Detroit or in Buffalo, New York, for example, clocking in fugitives as they embarked for Canada. But it is possible to estimate with some reasonable reliability that at least 100,000 people succeeded in escaping slavery via the Underground Railroad. That's a pretty conservative figure. I think it actually could be a few tens of thousands more than that over a 60-year period from about 1800 to 1860. To put that in perspective, there were 4 million slaves in the United States in 1860. So we're talking about a very small proportion of enslaved people. Most people who ran for freedom were caught. They were re-enslaved. And only a minority succeeded in reaching the North.
And the enormous effort that was put out to recapture them and bring them back, this justified, these were expensive, well, you described them as human furniture, as they were regarded at the time, but very expensive human tools.
That's exactly right. And it was costly. There's an economics of slavery and an economics of recapture as well, and an economics of the Underground, because the Underground itself required money to operate, and slave masters had to spend money to recover their property. In the 1830s, in Maryland, unless I'm mistaken, the fees for hunting fugitives were something like this. It was about $20 a head in the Pennsylvania border country, $50 in New York City, and about $120 up in Boston. And it was quite an investment to attempt to recapture a fugitive, but there was a whole industry of slave catching as well that involved many Northerners, lawyers, lawmen, and bounty hunters.
And taking care of these people as they were on the in the stations and en route, that had to be an expensive business too, as well as dangerous.
Yes, it was. It was, of course, most dangerous in the border country, say along the Ohio River, in the northern edge of the slave states, and along the Pennsylvania-Maryland state lines. It was indeed dangerous. The Underground was as secret as it could be, and it was deeply secret within the South. Now, I should say, though, that there's very, very little evidence of Underground Railroad activity in the Deep South, where a slave might be 500, 600 miles from the nearest free state. Very few people made it out of the Deep South. The great majority who reached freedom came from three states, Kentucky, Virginia, and Maryland. Further north, however, the underground was astonishingly open. Just to give you one example, in Syracuse, New York, the underground was led by a remarkable man, himself a fugitive slave named Germain Logan, a Congregationalist minister. And in the mid-1850s, he was so bold and felt so secure in the abolitionist stronghold of Syracuse that he published his address in the local newspapers with ads saying, "Station, Underground Railroad, Germain Logan." Fundraisers for Logan and the Underground were held in the city council chambers in Syracuse. Logan also published business cards, incidentally, that said, "Germain Logan, Station Master, Underground Railroad," and handed them around to anybody.
Fergus Borderwick is the author of Bound for Canaan, The Underground Railroad and the War for the Soul of America. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Let's get another caller on the line, and this is Cheryl Lee. Cheryl Lee is calling from Cleveland, Ohio.
Hi there. This is a wonderful program you're doing.
Thank you.
I'm originally from D.C., and out of D.C. Black Repertory Company, we had a philosophy of taking the community and creating something that would help it to grow. Well, coming into Cleveland, Ohio, I took that philosophy and stumbled upon the Underground Railroad as a Black History Month presentation. In the 20 years that I have worked on it and researched it, I have met hundreds and hundreds of school children and families, teachers, politicians who are in some way connected to the Underground Railroad by way of their family roots. The most wonderful aspect that I have discovered lately is that Ohio is truly the repository of not only the footsteps of Underground Railroad operators, station keepers, conductors, fugitives, but it is also the repository of those oral family histories. I've started a group called the Underground Railroad Family Trust, which is collecting Underground Railroad family histories from those families. Some of the aspects that you've mentioned about the railroad, it's economics. Yes, there was economics on both sides of the railroad, not just the slave hunters who paid for bounty keepers and whatnot, but the abolitionists themselves were very successful in raising monies through anti-slavery societies, the sale of books such as Uncle Tom's Cabin, which Harriet Beecher Stowe wrote, was very popular in winning recruits to the abolitionist side. But these people recognized that freeing slaves not only gave them a new lease on life, it changed the economics in the North. One of the aspects or ideas of ending slavery was to take away the source of labor, and the South recognized that was the biggest danger. In bringing fugitives north, it helped to underwrite some of the policies of the Free Soil Party, which sought to, which endorsed free soil, free speech, free labor, and free men.
And which was an important factor in the creation of the Republican Party.
Exactly. It was the early forefronter. In fact, it was a party in its own, only for about 4 or 5 years, I understand. But just about every abolitionist on the North Coast made it a point to make that party work in favor of emancipation. The figure you use, 100,000 fugitive slaves getting to freedom, is very conservative. In the state of Ohio alone, on its three main trunk routes, records were kept along the way by local grassroots operators and station keepers. And if you go to the Canadian side and look at their census records, and the records kept among the five fugitive settlements that were established in Ontario and...
Well, the numbers are, as Fergus Borgerdwick said, are in dispute. He said at least 100,000, and they are, as he said, the holy grail of research. Cheryl Lee, thank you very much for the phone call.
It was a wonderful program. Thank you so very much.
Appreciate it. When we come back, we're going to focus on the legacy of the Underground Railroad movement. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Now let's complete our discussion about the Underground Railroad with Fergus Bordewick, who's written about it in his book Bound for Canaan, Bound for Canaan, the Underground Railroad and the War for the Soul of America. If you'd like to join us, it's 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. And Fergus Bordewick, this was a minority movement, as you describe it, when it first started. A few people and attitudes were very difficult to change, but the Underground Railroad and the abolitionist movement had, you say, a moral persuasion far beyond its numbers.
Yeah, yes, indeed. Abolitionists were very few in number and treated as virtually beneath contempt by most Americans, most white Americans, at the beginning of the 1800s. And by the 1850s, particularly thanks to both the cutting-edge efforts of the Underground Railroad, which brought fugitive slaves for the first time into northern communities and introduced white northerners for the first time to people who had been enslaved and made them flesh and blood, people with families and life stories, and thanks also to the highly effective propaganda efforts of the abolitionist movement as a whole, speakers such as Frederick Douglass and so many others, countless hearts and minds had been changed by the 1850s. And although I don't think a majority of white Americans in the North ever embraced abolitionism in their souls, enough did that they were able to shift the center of gravity of the North.
Let's get another caller on the line, and this is Margaret. Margaret's with us from Memphis, Tennessee.
Hi, thank you so much. I have Quaker ancestors of whom I am very proud and would like to hear you speak of the legacy, my sense from studying Gandhi and Martin Luther King and so forth, nuclear disarmament, is that the Quakers went on to have an enormous quiet impact on women's vote, human rights and civil rights struggles and struggles to end violence ever since. And I may be just being excited about my family tradition, but I wish you would speak some more about that and also about frustrations that these women encountered as Quaker women who were allowed to be bold and progressive when they went on to continue that passion to see the Holy Spirit in everyone.
Well, thanks for bringing up that question. I think you've yourself pretty eloquently expressed the impact that Quakers had on progressive causes, beginning with anti-slavery and continuing ever since then, although it does have to be said that not all Quakers were really of one mind.
Oh,
and
right.
Some of the most active Quakers in the underground were actually disowned, forced out of their meetings because of their activities. But that said, I do want to say something about women and the underground, and that's that I don't think it's widely known that the Underground Railroad was, and the larger abolitionist movement, both of which were heavily populated with Quakers, were the seedbed of American feminism.
Yeah.
And all the women, several of them Quaker or Quaker-related, who formed the first Women's Rights Conference in Seneca Falls, New York, in 1848,
yeah,
came out of the Underground Railroad.
So go ahead, Margaret.
No, I just there was a photograph in Life magazine a number of years ago that showed that the photograph taken at that conference, and one of my women ancestors is in that picture, and I just am so proud whenever I get to look at that picture. It's a great story, and I'm glad you're helping tell it.
Thank you very much, Margaret, for the phone call. The Underground Railroad and the abolitionist movement, you say, contributed a lot to progressive politics.
Well, indeed, the Underground Railroad, perhaps most importantly, after the fact of its having saved so many tens of thousands of lives of fugitive slaves, most importantly, was the first racially integrated political movement in American history. It was also the first mass political movement of civil disobedience after the American Revolution. And it really was it began, I think, our ongoing tradition of kind of grassroots radicalism and the tradition Americans still prize. all the way across the political spectrum, I think, if we're honest about it, of defying authority on behalf of higher principles.
Yeah.
Although what we think those principles are does vary from generation to generation.
Yeah, you do write that this was a movement that held itself responsible to a higher law, and make a direct comparison to the pro-life movement, to people who attack abortion clinics.
Well, yes, indeed. And in that sense, I think the history of the Underground Railroad is fairly provocative, because it challenges us to really think seriously about the meaning and impact of political movements from different ends of the political spectrum that appeal to higher laws than the laws of men. For example, the Underground Railroad, as I said earlier, came out of the evangelical fundamentalist movement of the early 19th century. Now, one thing that means is that fundamentalism, the evangelical movement, was a contributor to modern American liberalism and racial radicalism. But it also, I think, challenges both people who may be in today's far, far, far more conservative evangelical movement to look at the political consequences of some of the choices they may make on today's issues. But it challenges people on the more leftward end of the spectrum to realize that religion is part of this country's progressive history.
Let's get another caller on the line. Greg. Greg's calling from Sugar Grove in Pennsylvania.
Hi, I'm the director of the Underground Railroad Convention in Sugar Grove, and we have more than 30 local abolitionists that we have impersonated each year, and we do six national abolitionists like Frederick Douglass and J.W. Logan, whom Mr. Borderick mentioned, William Wells Brown, and a variety of other people. And we also include, because it was part of the same movement, suffrage speakers. But what I was curious about and wondered if Mr. Borderick could comment on is, in our study, the year we bring back to life is 1854, which is the year the Kansas-Nebraska Act was passed. And when you look at a map of the red states and blue states today, and you look at a map of 1854, there are only three states that are exceptions to that colored designation from that time period. And I wondered if Mr. Borderick had any comment on that.
Well, gosh, you know, as an historian, I'm a little wary of trying to draw analogies between a period a century and a half ago and the present day. But yeah, I mean, your observation is pretty accurate. But I think, the real answer to your question is, I think, looking at the patterns of settlement that reach back into the early Republic and where people came from who settled different parts of the country. And you can see on a micro scale that same kind of red and blue patchwork in the border country of states like Indiana and Ohio and Pennsylvania, depending on where early settlers had come from and where their regional and political loyalties were at the time, although I am wary of trying to impose the past as a template on the present or vice versa.
Greg, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
And Fergus Borderick, thank you so much for your time today.
Well, thank you very much for having me on the show.
Fergus Borderick's book is Bound for Canaan, The Underground Railroad and the War for the Soul of America.